This interview is being conducted Friday, June 13th, and an editorial in today's New York Times included this quote: "There is enormous confusion about what happened Tuesday night on Pakistan's border with Afghanistan. Pakistani officials say that American air and artillery strikes killed 11 of their paramilitary troops, and some are angrily demanding an end to all military cooperation. The Bush administration says that American forces were firing in self-defense against Taliban fighters crossing into Afghanistan, and made conflicting statements about whether any Pakistani troops had died. Although a center of global instability for many decades, this is just the latest example of why Pakistan may now be the most dangerous place on earth. Bordering Iran, Afghanistan, and its perennial enemy India, the nation straddles many racial and religious fault lines, with the impoverished majority Sunni population rubbing up against a minority of wealthy Shiites. The Islamic Republic has spawned thousands of unregulated religious seminaries whose graduates have gone on to fight across South Asia, Chechnya, the Philippines, most recently planned attacks in Madrid, London, and Frankfurt, Germany. In fact, almost every global terrorist plot carried out or prevented since 2004 has been traced to training, funding, or material support from al-Qaeda based in its northwest territories. And to top things off, there's Pakistan's unsecured nuclear weapons program and the Nuke Bazaar run for years by General Khan, which supplied several rogue states with nuclear technology and expertise. Following the murder of Benazir Bhutto, the change in Pakistan's government and military structure, and the ancient attempt on the life of Afghan President Hamid Karzai, the political climate is no more stable than it was 7 years ago, when today's guest, Ahmed Rashid, introduced the English-speaking world to the region in his New York Times bestseller, Taliban. That book has been translated into 26 languages, and the English-language version has sold over 1.5 million copies. In the meantime, the U.S. has spent over $10 billion since 2001 in aid to Pakistan, about half of which is reimbursement for conducting operations against extremists on behalf of the U.S., especially in Afghanistan. In his new book, Descent into Chaos, Rashid asks, what has gone wrong since the invasion of Afghanistan? Ahmed Rashid is a Pakistani journalist based in Lahore who writes for the Daily Telegraph of London, the Washington Post, the International Herald Tribune, the New York Review of Books, BBC Online, and The Nation. His books include Jihad, Taliban, The Resurgence of Central Asia, and his newest, Descent into Chaos. In January 2002, he established the Open Media Fund for Afghanistan, OMFA, which gives cash grants to newly starting independent print media in Afghanistan. Welcome, Ahmed Rashid.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Okay. First, just to stop, to jump on today's headlines, what is the latest on the incident at the border?
Well, nobody really knows, but I think a very strong indicator was that 2 days earlier, the chairman of the American Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, had visited Islamabad to hold talks with the Pakistani military chief. And when he came back, he issued a very, very blunt statement saying that the next terrorist attack in the United States will probably take place from the tribal areas of Pakistan. Now, that is about the bluntest statement that any American has made in recent days. And the feeling perhaps in Pakistan is that that statement was then followed by a hands-off to American forces in Afghanistan, that if you are harassed in any way by Pakistani forces, go for them. So I think this was a very strong message possibly sent by the Americans to the Pakistani military. The Pentagon, as far as I know, has been very adamant in defending its position, but so has the Pakistani military. But I think the message back home, which is simply that the Americans are now very frustrated and very fed up with the Pakistani military.
Okay, so you're saying not necessarily that is what happened, that might be what happened, but that interpretation is definitely alive.
Certainly, the perception and interpretation based on Mullen's statement 2 days earlier, you know, because his statement was very negative because he had come back after talks. And although, of course, he didn't say it, it was quite obvious that the talks had failed.
And the talks were aimed at?
Well, the talks were aimed at getting Pakistani cooperation in and not cutting peace deals with the militants who are living on the Pakistan side of the border. Because what has happened is that the military has cut this peace deal with the what are now called the Pakistani Taliban. That is Pakistani militants who are working with the Afghan Taliban and working with al-Qaeda. And The army has been cutting peace deals with them. And what these peace deals do is simply the militants stop attacking Pakistani forces, but carry on attacking American forces and U.S. security and Afghan government forces across the border in Afghanistan. And the Americans are very upset that these are one-sided peace deals. You know, they may stop attacking you, but they're still attacking us. So, you know, this is not a peace deal.
Right, right. This is a ceasefire against one side. One side. Yeah. And one side of one side.
Yeah, exactly.
What has been – now, these peace deals that the military was negotiating, that was going on while Musharraf was clearly the man in power. What has changed – and now I'll allow you to broaden out a little bit. What has changed since the sequence of events that Americans know of, Benazir Bhutto's return to the nation, Benazir Bhutto's assassination, the election, the victory by forces not of Musharraf, and since then, not in the news so much. Well, what has happened?
What has changed simply is that we now have an elected civilian government, and it's a broad-based coalition of all the opposition parties to Musharraf. They are trying to stabilize the situation. They're finding it very hard because it's a complicated coalition, and they have a lot of issues which are dividing them. The biggest issue of all is the fate of Musharraf. Some of these parties in the government want Musharraf to resign immediately, or even to impeach Musharraf, to force him to get out. Other parties, such as the leading party, the Pakistan People's Party of Benazir Bhutto, want a more go-slow approach because they're very wary of creating another contradiction, another crisis with Musharraf and the army, which continues to back Musharraf. So you have a civilian government there. The army has traditionally been a very powerful political entity.
Well, I mean, in a way that Americans, as powerful as our Pentagon is, still might not understand. In other words, the way I gather it, the military in Pakistan has almost its own center of power, some of its own...
Well, it has vast economic power. It's in business. It's in finance. It's in property. It's the largest landowner in the country. It runs foreign policy effectively. It runs, you know, the intelligence services. It doesn't share any of that information with the civilian government. So, you know, you have a very, very powerful military. And essentially, the military controls, even though there's a civilian government, the military has not given over control of foreign policy to the civilians. They are controlling policy towards India, Pakistan's ancient enemy, and to Afghanistan. And in this recent peace deal, the civilians are upset simply because the military did not tell them that they were doing this.
Well,
and now the Americans are very upset, and the Americans are upset naturally at the government, which is a civilian government. Now, the civilian government is not in a position to say, well, I'm sorry, President Bush, but actually we really haven't got a clue what is going on because the military never tells us anything. So it's a very, very complicated internal situation where I think a lot of the blame must lie on the military rather than on the civilian government.
So let's also, where is Musharraf now? What is his role officially, unofficially?
Well, Musharraf is very discredited. He's deeply unpopular. Last year, he had to reinstate martial law for 3 months, which was made him even more unpopular. He beat up a lot of people, put a lot of people into jail, suspended the constitution, sacked the judges of the Supreme Court, everything that made him extremely unpopular. And but the issue is that Musharraf remains very powerful. The presidential powers that he has accrued to himself in the last few years have been enormous. He can dismiss the prime minister. He can dismiss the parliament. He can dismiss the army chief. He's got a lot of powers. But he really can't exercise them at the moment simply because he's too weak. His other major source of support has been President Bush. Bush has refused to come down strongly in support of the coalition government, of the new elected government, even though it's a secular government. It is a big step forward from what we had in the past. But Bush is still supporting Musharraf, and this is antagonizing and annoying a lot of Pakistanis.
Okay. Musharraf has not resigned. All those things he was doing, which seemed to be alienating people, was in the run-up to an election that he assumed he would win? Until Bhutto's return and assassination?
He assumed that there would be a hung parliament. He assumed that Bhutto would not win, Bhutto's party would not win outright, that there would be a hung parliament. His party would still do quite well. In fact, what happened was that there was a landslide in support of the opposition parties. The military's party lost very, very badly, and the Islamic fundamentalist parties lost very badly, which was a very strong indication that people were turning away from this kind of Talibanization, Islamism, which was being promoted by Musharraf and the military and by the former government.
Now, that's interesting. You just said that the Talibanization, the Sharia orientation and so on was being promoted by Musharraf and the military openly?
Well, ostensibly they were against it. But in reality, what was happening was that, if you remember last year, a bunch of militants seized a mosque in Islamabad, endangering the lives of all the diplomats. That crisis went on for 6 months, and people couldn't understand why Musharraf was not ending it. And the reason was simply he wanted to create a threat, a danger, which would force the Americans once again to give more money, to support him, to say, there's a big danger in Islamabad, Musharraf's under threat, we better support him. And people are very, very cynical now the way Musharraf has manipulated this whole issue of Islamism in order to maintain this threat for so many years, while at the same time the intelligence services and the military have been fueling the Islamist, especially against India. They have supported the militants in Kashmir who have been fighting the Indian forces. And most importantly of all, as far as Afghanistan is concerned, the military has been giving sanctuary to the leadership of the Afghan Taliban since 2001. If you remember, the Taliban were never defeated. They were routed by Americans, and many of them fled into Pakistan, including the leadership. And the leadership has been very, you know, well ensconced there in Pakistan ever since.
Okay. One of the things that I would love you to do when I began to, both with your book and elsewhere, do research on this, is I suddenly realized how ignorant not only I am, but so many of us are. What is the Northwest Frontier Province and what is the federally administered tribal areas? How are those two related?
Well, the Northwest Frontier Province is one of the four provinces of Pakistan. And it's a federation. Pakistan is a federation. So the four provinces have their own provincial governments, and they come together in the center where they're given a share of money and taxes, and so they can govern themselves more or less. Autonomy is kind of guaranteed in the constitution. FATA, the Federal Administered Tribal Area, is... It was a buffer territory created by the British between Afghanistan, which was then independent, and what was then British India. And it was to allow these Pashtun tribes, the Pashtun ethnic group is the major ethnic group in that region, which they straddle Afghanistan and they also live in Pakistan. It was to give the Pashtun tribes some degree of autonomy, which didn't bring them directly under British control and didn't bring them under Afghan control either. It created a kind of no man's land there where these Pashtuns would agree to govern themselves to a large extent. Now, what has happened is that since Pakistan was created in 1947, this buffer state and these laws of FATA have remained. And FATA today is governed by the president in lieu of the British. It's governed directly by the president, but does not come under the Pakistan constitution. It doesn't have any of the laws or rules.
It is not a province.
It's not a province. It doesn't have a government of its own or anything like that. Now, so this new no man's land is now basically the area that is controlled by the Afghan and Pakistani Taliban. And what Pashtuns have been saying in Pakistan for a long time, and what liberals have been saying in the rest of Pakistan, is that this area must be brought under Pakistan. There must be political reform there. They should come under the constitution, under the rule of law. They should receive the same services, education, health, electricity, etc., as everyone else in Pakistan does. But so far, at least, this hasn't happened. And this very ambiguous situation has continued since 1947.
Now, it seems to me, given what you were just saying about the military and the intelligence, Musharraf and so on, liking to keep that extremist threat alive, this no man's land fits that strategy very, very well.
It does, because precisely because, you know, this FATA, this no man's land, was used by the Pakistan intelligence and by the CIA in the 1980s to arm the Afghan Mujahideen. Every time the Soviets, who were then occupying Afghanistan, protested and said, "You're arming these people," you know, the army would say, "Where? I mean, it's not in Pakistan. And if you're talking about FATA, well, that's not under our jurisdiction.
We can't do anything about it."
Yeah. So, and the same thing was done in order to train and arm the Mujahideen in Kashmir in the 90s. The same thing was done to help the Taliban in Afghanistan in the 90s. And, of course, unfortunately, the same thing remains, is still being done, because many of the Afghan Taliban leaders are still living in FATA quite freely.
Right. And so, given this situation where we have a coalition government of limited power, but lots of popular support. Yes?
It has lots of popular support, very little power. And the problem is it's in a very chaotic situation at the moment because it's infighting amongst itself.
Right. As much as it has popular support and little power, it is not a united situation. Then you have the military, the intelligence with power. You have the United States. Where do they sit right now? And I would guess the other thing that's going on there is they're only in for a few more months.
Well, I mean, this administration has not stopped supporting Musharraf, and that is what is creating a lot of anti-Americanism in Pakistan. After all, Pakistanis last year had a massive civil movement, lawyers, women, NGOs, journalists, etc. This was a middle-class, urban, educated movement. It was anti-extremism.
It was pro-democracy. It was everything we say we're for.
Of course, of course. And you didn't support it. This administration didn't support it. This administration continues to support Musharraf. Just a week earlier, there were rumors in Islamabad that Musharraf may be forced to resign. And Bush issued another statement in support of Musharraf.
Right. Well, I saw a quote from you in April 07, I think, with Terry Gross on Fresh Air. You said the Bush administration prefers dealing with authoritarian regimes in this so-called war on terror. It's just much easier. I think the last thing the Bush administration would like to see is an elected government in Pakistan.
Well, I think that's very true, because an elected government is complicated. Authority is dispersed. You know, you have to deal with parliament, with the prime minister, etc. And unfortunately, in both the wars in Iraq, the wars in Afghanistan that the U.S. has launched, they've always preferred to deal with one man. It's much easier to get the authority of one man working rather than dealing with democratically elected institutions.
Yeah. And in terms of we'll move off Pakistan to the wider region in a second, but as on the street in Pakistan, given all these forces in play that we've just described, do people really expect nothing much to change until after the new administration comes in the United States?
Well, I mean, people are first of all expecting something to change with this new government in Pakistan. I mean, they would like to see this new government be more effective, deal with unemployment and the economic problems, which are very
severe. And there's hope for that.
And I think there is hope for that. It needs time to stabilize. The question is the army and Musharraf going to give it time to stabilize? You know, the second, I think, issue is, yes, there's a lot of expectancy for a new American administration. People are fed up with Bush, very tired of this administration, and they would like to see a U.S. administration come in which would support democracy and which would support civil society. For example, I mean, 80% of the aid that the Americans have given since 9/11, some nearly $11 billion, 80% of that aid has gone to the military.
Right, and now, as we pointed out earlier in this conversation, that's not just to the military within the government. That's to the military separate from the government.
Yeah, exactly. And what we would like to see, obviously, is more aid to the civilian government, more aid for the social sector, health, education, etc. You know, I keep reminding Americans, you know, this huge spate of aid that has come. I mean, where are your landmarks? Have you built in a university in Pakistan? Have you built a hospital? Have you trained doctors and nurses? I mean, name me one landmark that one can say in the last 8 years that the Americans can say, this is for the people of Pakistan.
Right.
This is not for the military of Pakistan.
Right. And they weren't even successful in propping up their own, the people they were giving the money to, in some sense, in that now there is this division between the government and Musharraf. Since the war in Afghanistan began, what has gone right?
Very good question. You know, I mean, it's what has gone right? There have been some positive achievements, without a doubt. For example, I think if you look at the health situation in Afghanistan, if you look at education, there's been a huge 6 million children are back to school, which was, you know, very difficult to imagine at during the Taliban regime when all schools were virtually shut down. Women are working now.
So you're talking about in Afghanistan?
In Afghanistan. Is that what you asked?
I meant the region, but yes, you're doing fine. Well, you're saying there has been
been some progress, but the real crisis in Afghanistan has been that the Americans, the Western Alliance, did not rebuild the infrastructure of the country, which was essentially needed to kickstart the economy. You cannot have an economy without electricity, without water, without roads, without communications, and that has just not happened. So the Europeans, the United Nations, for example, have concentrated on the easier subjects, if you like, women's empowerment, education, health, helping villages, small development projects. But you haven't. But the big boys, you know, the United States, England, the World Bank, they were needed to implement major, expensive infrastructure projects.
Just for people, again, we don't hear enough. What's the population of Afghanistan?
It's about 30 million.
About 30 million. And how large is it?
It's about the size of Iraq.
Okay, which is also about 30 million. So similar. And what you're saying is to establish that country, to reestablish that country as a functioning country, infrastructure is one of your first orders of business, or else what you end up with is what you have, which is sections kind of independently warlord-run and that sort of thing?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, it took 2 years before Karzai managed to persuade President Bush to build the first road. You know, now that was really ridiculous. I mean, the Americans, when they won the war, they should have started road building almost immediately, because road building has important military assets also. There's still no power, you know, in the country. 6% of Afghans have power.
6% have electricity.
That's all. In Kabul, you get electricity for 4 hours every other night.
Oh, my God.
Right? There's no power
in Kabul,
during the day.
That's the capital. That's the best.
3 million people live there. And Kabul, they set up, you know, I mean, the Americans have set up industrial zones in Kabul for industry to come in. But what industry is going to come in when there's no power? You know, and so the industry has to generate its own power. Nobody's going to set up a factory in a country where there's no power. And you know, the whole of life just comes to a standstill. Workshops don't work. You can't go to the restaurants. There's no power. Students can't study. You know, babies can't be delivered, etc.
Let me ask a question to put that in perspective. When was the last time that at least Kabul, even, and maybe a few other cities, had power, were functioning normally? Was that happening under the Taliban, or does it go back before the Soviet war?
There was full power under the Soviets in Afghanistan, in the major urban areas. There's never been much power in the rural areas anyway. Afghanistan is a poor country. But the Soviets maintained the power running. What actually destroyed the whole ability to generate power was the civil war in the 90s, after the Soviets left. The situation has just got worse and worse. So by the time that 9/11 came along, there was very little power in the country. So one of the first things the coalition should have done would have been to install powerhouses. And not a single one has been built in the last 7 years.
Let me come right to that. You were in Pakistan watching what happens. The 9/11 happens. The war happens very soon thereafter. The war, for what it accomplished it pretty quickly. Was there hope in Pakistan? Did it look like at that point that had we retained our focus on Afghanistan, that history might be different?
Yeah, I think it would have been entirely different. I mean, if you had maintained the focus on Afghanistan and you had not been diverted by the war in Iraq, I think the American resources would have stayed in Afghanistan, and you possibly would not have had this whole rebirth of the Taliban. I mean, it was the vacuum of power and vacuum of authority and rebuilding in those intervening years, 2002, 2003, 2004, which allowed the Taliban to come back, because the Taliban went to the Afghan people and said, you've allowed the Americans in, you've welcomed them as liberators, you have said that, you know, they will rebuild our country. And what have they done? They've done absolutely nothing. We told you that they would never do anything. These are foreigners. These are infidels. You should immediately join us and kick them out. And that was the start of the Taliban resurgence.
So I see. So the divergence into Iraq both created a recruitment situation in Iraq for terrorists and extremists, and returned one to Afghanistan.
I think the war in Iraq was being considered and prepared for as early as 12 weeks after the end of the war in Afghanistan. That is by March 2002, just 3 months after the war ended. Some of the best resources of the U.S., I show in my book, were being pulled out. I show how the U.S. Special Forces, who were speaking local languages, were pulled out to retrain for Iraq. Satellite surveillance was removed so that they could send them over Iraq. The best intelligence facilities, which were hunting down al-Qaeda, they were removed. So, you know, it was a real depletion of resources.
What should Americans ask now of the candidates running for president right now in terms of Afghanistan and Pakistan? And you have about a minute.
I think the most important is there has to be a refocus on Afghanistan. There has to be much greater pressure and incentive for Pakistan to give up on the sanctuaries where the Taliban are living and where the Taliban are getting support from. There has to be a much more coordination between the civil and military in Pakistan to combat the Talibanization that's taking place there. The Americans need to help Pakistan as much as it is helping Afghanistan. There has to be a much better mixture of carrot and stick for both countries to get on and improve the situation.
Any indication of either candidate being more in that vein?
Well, Obama, I must say, has given some very positive statements on Afghanistan. He has said that he will focus much more on Afghanistan, that Bush has neglected Afghanistan. McCain, unfortunately, has not said anything very significant about Afghanistan.
Okay, I'm going to have to end it there. So again, the book is Descent into Chaos, The United States, The Failure of Nation Building in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia. The author and my guest today, Ahmed Rashid. You can learn more at ahmedrashid.com. Thank you, Ahmed Rashid. Keep up the good work.
Thank you very much.